Run.
All right, we are back on. This is a continuation of yesterday's title board setting hearing. We're meeting today in the Aspen Room at the Secretary of State's office, which is on the third floor, 1700 Broadway. The date is Friday, April 25th, and we have four additional matters held over from yesterday for rehearing. The first matter is Initiative 2013-2014, number 103. And there was a motion for rehearing filed by Mr. Kaufman. Okay, great. If you could come up and...
Madam Chair, I believe there are two motions to rehearing filed by Mr. Kaufman.
Oh.
That's correct.
Yes, okay. Whichever you want.
Steve, if you make sure the microphone's on. Just push the button that says push.
Brighter green light. Madam Chair, members of the board, we have two jurisdictional issues today. The first is a new one since our motion for rehearing is filed. Designated Representative Barbara Mills Bria is not present today, was not present yesterday. Section 140-106-4A requires that each designated representative shall appear at any title board meeting where a ballot issue is considered. And Section 4B requires that each designated representative must sign an affidavit at the first title board hearing. Respectfully, we do not believe that there's any authorization for a new designated representative to sign the affidavit at a rehearing. Thus, we respectfully question whether the board has jurisdiction to allow the proponents to proceed with a brand new designated representative at this late stage of the proceedings. Ms. Mills Bria has been the designated representative throughout, up through the first hearing, along with Mr. Doe, up through the first hearing that was held last week. I believe there was some reference yesterday to the 2012 Supreme Court decision on this statute in Hayes versus Otke, where the court recognized that this statutory requirement is both unambiguous and inflexible, and that the intent and purpose of this requirement is that the designated representatives be available to explain the measures, to answer the board's questions, including answering the board's questions on review and comment hearing. Mr. Doe and Mills Bria were the designated representatives at the review and comment hearing on the similar initiatives based on which legislative council waived review and comment on Initiative 103. They have been the designated representatives throughout Initiative 103, continuing through this board's hearing last week. I don't know if the board wants to hear other jurisdictional arguments at this point or to address this issue first.
If you could do all jurisdictional, and then we'll have the we'll get a response from staff and the proponent.
Okay. And the jurisdictional issue raised in our motion for rehearing is the question of multiple subjects. We believe Initiative 103 contains at least four subjects. First, it would create a constitutional form of a public trust doctrine based on a newly created common property interest in the environment and certain natural resources designated as public trust resources. That's in Section 1. Also in Section 1, it would create a new inalienable right to a clean and preserved environment. And Section 4 includes creation of a new crime based on manipulation of data. And then Section 5 would retroactively apply new conditions and requirements to any applicable federal, state, local permits, regardless of when they were granted, thus impairing established property rights. The primary focus of the initiative is creating a public trust in the environment and resources as a common property right. This is broad and sweeping and necessarily takes away private property rights by bringing them into common property. Similar themes have appeared in Initiative 89 that the board reviewed last week, Mr. Doe, one of the designated representatives of this measure, also as some of the board members may recall, was a proponent of a couple of public trust initiatives 2 years ago, initiatives 3 and 45 regarding a public trust in water resources, and of initiative 17 in 2017, which involved a public trust standard for state agency decision making. Similar to that, what the court found on that measure, initiative 103 simply recasts the words of the public trust standard in a different form, but in a way that constitutes a separate subject from other subjects in this measure. The other subjects, I believe, are surreptitious subjects coiled up in the folds, just as the public trust standard was found to be in the 2007 case, creating a new inalienable constitutional right, certainly is a subject all in and of itself. Retroactive application to previous permits includes permits that have granted property rights, but this is unrelated to the designation of common property rights and the public trust in that common property. And last but not least, creation of a new crime to be specified but vaguely defined in the Constitution is a separate subject. It's not necessary to the purpose of the initiative. These other three subjects are not necessarily or properly connected to the primary theme of the public trust, nor do they have a necessary or proper connection to one another. And those are our jurisdictional points for this hearing.
All right, thank you. And Jim? Yeah, or you can incorporate his comments or whatever you want.
May it please the board, Sarah Pilati appearing on behalf of the objectors, Mr. Cordero and Mr. Prestige. I'd just like to reiterate Mr. Lenhart's comments about the jurisdictional issues. As he said, the designated representative, Barbara Mills Bria, is not present today. The Supreme Court case, Hayes versus Otke, requires strict construction of the statute requiring both proponents to be here. She's not here. This is a pretty black and white issue. There's also the same single subject requirement, so we'd like to incorporate. There's, at a bare minimum, at least three subjects in this proposal. The establishment of a common property right to all public trust resources, imposing upon the state a public trusteeship to protect these public trust resources, which is not recognized in the Colorado Constitution, and then creating a new preemption scheme whereby any applicable local, state, or federal permit previously recognized would be superseded by this doctrine. This, of course, is completely separate from the establishment of a common property right or from the establishment of a public trust.
Thank you. On the issue of the proponents, Mr. Ward, do you want to?
So we have a notarized affidavit from Ms. Mills Bria withdrawing as a designated representative, along with a notarized affidavit and an affidavit of designated representative from Sandra Tolan appointing herself as a new designated representative. Mr. Doe has signed both of these notarized documents consenting to the switch out of designated representatives.
Okay, and did you say we have a rule on that?
There is nothing in rule, although we have used this procedure in the past.
Okay. All right. Do you want to come up and respond?
As to that matter,
jurisdictional, to the single subject and an issue about the substitution.
Sure. Single subject. Public trust. This is the United States Supreme Court. This is what they said in the Illinois Central case, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. The public trust doctrine is of ancient origin. Its roots trace to Roman civil law, and its principles can be found in English common law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not creating anything. We're simply memorializing something that already exists. And it's our right to protect which is ours against overreach, statutory overreach by government. And as to what our rights are, which seem to be in some question, I'd like to turn to our state constitution and the Bill of Rights. Section 1, vestment of political power. We take this stuff seriously. All political power is vested and derived from the people. All government of right originates from the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the whole. And then as to inalienable rights, which seems to be the source of some confusion here, and this is Section 3, all persons have certain natural, essential, and inalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. Now, if we do not have the right to protect that which is ours, what rights do we have? And all this initiative is doing is establishing a way of protecting the public's resources against overreach and a regulatory system which doesn't seem to be working for us. And that's my statement on this. That's where we stand. It's a simple principle. It's, you know, it's a conceptual thing, but it's one purpose.
Any questions for any of the?
Well, do you want to? Let me just address, I guess, the substitution, right? The way I read the case and the statute, the only real question for us is whether we have in front of us the designated representatives. And so, in other words, is the substitution effective, right? If it is effective, then we're fine. If it's not, then the Hayes case requires us to say we don't have jurisdiction. I think I'm understanding our situation correctly.
Yes.
So, seems to me that there should be a process by which people can substitute a new designated representative, either for instances like this, or someone could imagine an even more dire situation in which one of the proponents is actually incapacitated. Doesn't seem to me that that should mean they can't go forward. So I would give effect to the substitution and move on.
I would, too, for those same reasons, that there has to be a way to do a substitution. The case that was referred to was a case where the opponents or the proponents were not in the room, and that's a little bit different than allowing for a substitution, which we've heard has been notarized and authorized by the other representatives, so I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, absent some indication that we don't have authority to do a substitution or some statute or rule that says we've done it the wrong way, which I don't think exists, it seems appropriate to me.
We're going to vote on it. So why don't we vote on that issue? Do you want to do a motion on?
Sure. I guess, is it a denial of rehearing at this point, or is it just a motion to find that we have jurisdiction? I just move that we have jurisdiction to continue on. Let's see. And that's not being removed due to having a new designated proponent.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. So now we're on to the single subject question. Does anyone have any questions for the proponent or opponent?
I do. I have a question. The initiative refers to natural resources. What does that cover?
Well, I think it goes on to say air, water, land, but that isn't all inclusive. The public's air, land, and water. I mean, those are among the natural resources.
Right. What I'm asking is, what other ones do you think fall under that term?
I think you could say state parks, wildlife, which is a public resource.
Okay.
That's not meant to be all-inclusive. I mean, we've always said there would have to be rulemaking on this, and somebody's going to have to decide what the limitations are.
Okay.
We resisted, as I think you know, when this was under review with legal counsel, trying to define every issue. It's just like the issue of what is substantial impairment. I can tell you what substantial impairment means to me, but I don't think that we have to be so broad that we define these things at this point.
Okay. No, I'm done for now.
I guess I have a bit of a question. So I understand what you're saying partly is that, if I'm not mistaken, your position is essentially you shouldn't have to do this, right? Your reading of the various parts of the Constitution is that we basically, this is should have been the situation all along, essentially, right? But your comment about English common law and the quote from Illinois Central that that's come up in the past, I think what the petitioners, the objectors, are saying is it would be one thing to just say, look, we're going to impose this public trust idea that's consistent with English common law. It's this general established idea. But you've also kind of gone a step beyond that and added a number of very specific provisions that aren't necessarily what you would come up with under the kind of generic historic understanding. The criminal offense, the local versus state preemption idea. And so that, I think, is their point, is establishing a public trust idea, maybe even common property, is one thing. Going then the next step and kind of, in some ways, micromanaging the meaning of that, tweaking it, how it would work out in practice, is perhaps takes you out of the kind of general idea that, for example, the water context came up, and makes it more like situations that the Supreme Court has said your sort of use of a big broad idea is covering these very specific and potentially important aspects of the measure that aren't necessarily part of the general idea of a public trust.
Do you want to respond?
Yes, please.
Well, our experience, and I think the legal experience of people that deal in public trust, namely Hap Dunning at the University of California, Davis, who's one of the chief legal experts on this subject, do not believe that public trust will be observed unless there are pretty specific provisions providing for the enforcement. And this is the Colorado Supreme Court on this very issue, I think it's germane to that issue. The single subject requirement must be liberally construed so as not to impose undue restrictions on the initiative process. To that end, the single subject requirement does not preclude the use of provisions that are not wholly integral to the basic idea of the proposed initiative. All we're trying to, I mean, this is, as you know, this is a laborious process. And it takes a lot of people's efforts to get this done. But I think, you know, if you look at the public's reaction to how the environment is being treated and how the public's resources are being treated, I think we all have an obligation to allow the public to vote on this issue. How do we want to protect the environment? You know, there's an experiment in biology where you put a frog in a pond and then you slowly turn up the heat. And you slowly continue to turn up the heat until it boils and the frog dies. There are some people of the opinion that that's what we're doing to our environment and our natural resources. And all we're trying to do is protect those things for this generation and the coming generations. That's all we're trying to do, and we think it has to have teeth.
I thought you were going to compare that to a title board hearing.
Oh. Well, I'm not a lawyer. I just have to tell you what I'm thinking. I'm sorry.
Now, I understand. I think the concern is you're exactly right. How are we going to deal with this perceived problem? And the question that I think we sort of have to ask ourselves is, are there people, does it make sense to say all these things should be in the same measure? Or if you want to impose a public trust, great, go for it. But if you want to rearrange the preemption system, you might have to ask people separately if that's an additional step they want to take. Or if you want to criminalize certain types of information gathering, that might be a separate issue. I those are the questions I think I have, that, sure, you can ask people these questions, but can you make them choose all or nothing? And I think this, to me, is a close case. I'm probably inclined to go forward, but I do think it's a close case.
May I just say, I'll try to be on point, at least as my legal, non-legal mind perceives it. I mean, let's take, for instance, something that I think is tantamount to this. Let's say that the public wanted to reform public education. I think it would be illogical and naive to think that if they were going to reform education, they'd have to do it first K, then 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then five, because they're all somewhat different, but it's all under the concept of public education. I think that's what we're arguing here, is the concept of public trust, and we want it to work. We simply want it to work. And there's a mechanism there to make it work, and that's all we're asking for.
Okay. I don't think I have any more questions.
Okay. No. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, sure.
Well, I guess it's time for me to go into sort of some rather long and hopefully somewhat clear explanation, because I did vote to find a single subject last time, and I don't plan to vote that way today. So that sort of change of mind, especially when it's not necessarily based particularly on what's in the motions for rehearing, I think it's appropriate to explain that. So first, as to last time, why I thought then that this had a single subject was, it's certainly very broad, but at least reading it on its face, it seemed that everything was connected to a broad purpose, which for me is essentially something like a public right to environment or environmental protection. I don't know that I saw much log rolling, you know, that there's anything in here sort of designed to induce people who are not, who would not consider themselves in favor of environmental protection sort of generally to sign up for this. And I don't know that it's deliberately or intentionally surreptitious. And then we have the precedent from number 3. 2 years ago, which was also quite broad. And I was sort of left with the question, well, based on all those factors in the precedent, is just expanding this doctrine beyond water into all this other stuff seem like too big? And my instincts were saying, yeah, this is just too much. But I couldn't find a case on point that necessarily said, well, a subject can be just too big. Even the cases with, say, water and those types of things, it was always not really so much that the term was too big, but that what was under it wasn't necessarily and properly connected. And at the time, I thought these things might be. Now, as for why I'm inclined to change my mind, in looking at this more, I started to get concerned for sort of what does preservation of the environment and natural resources mean? And what I think is a lot of people could look at this, voters, and think they're voting on protecting the air and the water, basically. So I looked up natural resources, a variety of definitions from the OECD, among other places, and it includes a lot. It includes things like soil, timber, game, which I think a proponent acknowledged, you know, fish, mineral resources. And in considering that, then I ran up against the other thing, which is we're not supposed to consider the effects of initiatives or what could happen with them. That said, relying on simply public surprise, I think the public would be surprised in voting on this to find out just how broad it really is likely to be, that it's likely to apply a public trust to just about everything. I'm not sure that someone couldn't say, you know, just cut off oil and gas, try to start an action to
prevent oil and gas drilling on someone's private property altogether. I think this could apply to things like grazing rights. And while we can't speculate too much, we do have to know generally what an initiative is going to do to find a single subject. And I just think that the use, especially next to each other, of the environment and natural resources, I think those are two different things, frankly, that natural resources encompasses a lot more than people are inclined to think it does in the context of the rest of the measure. And for that reason, I'm inclined to not find a single subject today.
Well, I, there's very little I disagree with in what you said, except I think the conclusion. I do think it's remarkably broad. I think there is a fairly good chance that people just reading environment or natural resources would not comprehend quite how far that could go. But to me, that doesn't necessarily make it separate subjects. Just as you said, makes it an incredibly broad subject. As I was, I think, revealing through my questions, I do, once you're dealing with something that broad, it does become, to me, and I think this is reflected in the case law, once you start dealing with something so broad, when you start kind of micromanaging it and having sort of specific provisions that are related but sort of not necessary to implement your broad vision, it starts to get troubling. And that's where I get a little bit concerned about this, in particular about the preemption is, to me, certainly, I assume, likely to be helpful, but is also kind of a major provision that that isn't necessarily part of it. You could certainly have a strong public trust, public ownership system of all these things, I think, without that aspect of it. But we've already approved dozens, hundreds, thousands of measures with local preemption efforts in them, and this one doesn't seem to me to cause a problem if those didn't. So I agree. I think it's a close case. I think trying to do something both so broad and then incorporating so many specifics is potentially problematic, but I don't think this quite goes over the line.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree this may be a case that the court would tell us we were wrong. Sometimes that's very hard to predict. I think that, I'm persuaded that even though it's a very broad topic, it is a single topic, which is the creation of the public trust. Because it creates a public trust over a lot of things, I don't think makes it a secondary subject. My greater concern was actually the part about the damages and the criminalizing, the manipulation, and all those kinds of things that are sort of separate from that concept. But they are all part of the same concept. And and I'm typically pretty liberal in my construction of single subject, just because of the right to petition and the fundamental nature of that right. And so I'm persuaded that it's single subject. And so I think it's our motion.
Okay, so then I'll move that we deny the motion for rehearing on motions for rehearing on jurisdictional grounds and find that the measure 103 has a single subject.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, so that passes 2-1. And now we're on to the language council. I'm not sure which order you want to go in, but come talk about the language, or if you want to come up together, that's fine too.
Good
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stephen Lenhart for Petitioner Douglas Kemper. With regard to the title language, first of all, would look at the phrase concerning a public trust in environmental resources, which I think is reflective of the problems that some of us and some of the board members were struggling with regarding, is this a single subject? If so, what is it? I think, first of all, it's too narrow in some respects. Environmental resources seems to me significantly more narrow than the environment and natural resources, as has been discussed this morning. The phrase concerning a public trust in environmental resources certainly gives no indication of creating a new crime or reopening previously granted federal and other permits. I think we've also got a catchphrase issue, and I know we had a similar issue on rehearing with Initiative 89 last week. I agree that the phrase public trust is central in this initiative. However, it's used here to mean something very different than the traditional public trust doctrine that Mr. Doe alluded to with the Illinois Central case and Roman law and common law. As explained in the Illinois Central decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, the public trust doctrine has traditionally been understood to mean a restraint on the sovereign's conveyance of tidelands and navigable waters and the underlying lands in order to protect public use for commercial navigation and fishing. Traditional public trust doctrine was further explained in a dissenting opinion on the court on Initiative 3 2 years ago, but it looks nothing like the public trust that's proposed in this initiative, and to the extent that the public has any basis to understand the phrase public trust as anything other than a catchphrase, it would have to be the traditional doctrine, and that's not the sense in which it's used here at all. Also, just to respond briefly to Mr. Doe's statement that this has always been the law, the U.S. Supreme Court also suggested in Illinois Central and recognized very clearly in another case 2 years ago called PPL Montana versus State of Montana, The public trust doctrine is not an issue of federal law. It's an issue of state law for each state to decide. And as the Colorado Supreme Court has decided in People versus Emmert and acknowledged in a few other decisions since then, the state of Colorado does not recognize a public trust doctrine either as a matter of common law or constitutional law, which is why anything that might be called a public trust in this initiative would be newly created. Our concerns with the title begin with that opening phrase. We also believe that the title improperly omits mention of two key features of the initiative and therefore is insufficient. It does not mention the creation of an inalienable right to specified features of the environment and natural resources, and an inalienable right certainly is an important concept constitutionally and one that should be disclosed in the title. The title also improperly omits mention of the retroactive application of requirements in the initiative to previously approved local, state, and federal permits.
Do you have any suggestion for what you believe the single subject would be?
I don't believe it's a single subject.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Anything? All right. Counsel, you want
to? This is Sarah Pilati again for objectors. Mr. Cordero, Mr. Prestige. The board kind of touched on this in the discussion of the single subject requirement, but I think this initiative is plagued by being too broad, misleading, and a lot of voters are going to be surprised. So even finding the single subject has been met, I think it's so vague that the board simply can't set a title that's going to accurately reflect the true intent of this provision. This was already touched on once, but I think more so on the natural resources side, but Section 1 discusses the preservation of the environment. Again, this term environment, I think, is a buzzword that voters are going to jump at. Everyone can get on board with this idea, but not recognizing how broad that is and how much that encompasses. The environment can be is defined by Black's Law Dictionary as a sum total of all surroundings of a living organism, including natural forces and other living things, which provide conditions for development and growth, as well as danger and damage. I think that's about as broad of a definition as you can find, and that's something that voters aren't going to understand how much is encompassed by this. Going on into Section 2, it states that the state government and its agents as trustees shall protect public trust resources against substantial impairment. Again, this is a really broad term. There's no standard given of what constitutes substantial impairment. And then combining that with the environment and natural resources, if I throw a Coke can in the Platte River, is that substantial impairment as opposed to pollution from plants on I-70? I don't think voters are understanding what kind of actions are going to be impacted with the way the title's currently set. There's no way for them to understand this initiative. Again, going on in Section 2, if an action or policy has a suspected risk of substantially impairing public trust resources, then the burden would fall to the proponent of the action or policy to show it is not harmful. Suspected risk is an extremely low standard that's going, again, voters aren't knowing that that's what they're getting themselves into and what types of actions are going to trigger this burden and that they can't go forward without proving that it's not harmful. Lastly, going on to Section 6, which I would note is not mentioned in the title, it states that laws may be enacted to enhance but cannot be contrary. This is even more vague than previous issues the board has dealt with of state versus local regulation. There's nothing in this section explaining whether a more restrictive regulation at the state would enhance this provision, whether it would be contrary. There's nothing giving guidance there. I think these broad definitions are going to lead to a lot of voter surprise when they find out what they've actually signed up for. You take that in connection with the fact that the title completely omits Section 5 and 6 of the initiative. Section 5 of the initiative, excuse me. States, this section is self-enacting and self-executing and shall apply to a public action or commercial dealing that would violate it, regardless of the date of any applicable local, state, or federal permit. I think there's an argument to be made that this would amount to a taking of, as we discussed, as the board already mentioned, that if natural resources includes mineral rights, previously recognized permits issued by federal, state, or local governments would no longer be recognized, and that could amount to a taking. Again, I think a voter is going to be surprised to find that in voting for what they thought was a preservation of natural resources, they've actually consented to a taking of their property rights. So for those reasons, I think the board must grant our motion and deny setting title because it's too vague and ambiguous.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
No.
All right. Do you want to come up and make any record as a proponent?
I like the title as set. I thought you did a good job. I would like to say something about language. And just because something has common usage doesn't make it hackneyed. You can say motherhood and apple pie, and that may be trite, but motherhood isn't. And the environment is a commonly used term that I think has common meaning to most people. And to assert or imply that the public doesn't know what it means by the environment, I think, is disingenuous. I think they do know. And when they're asked to vote on the environment, whether it should be protected or not, overwhelmingly, generally in surveys, over 70% say it should be protected. Give them the chance to figure out whether this is a good law or not.
Okay, thank you. I haven't really heard anything that would.
Well, I had there were a couple things that struck me. I was, I would at least consider taking the public trust language out of the single subject and referring instead to something like public ownership of natural and environmental resources, and then if we did that, we'd have to probably add a tiny bit at the beginning of the, before the definition. I also thought it was worth considering discussing kind of undoing existing permits potentially, or but I lean against that. Other than that, I was basically okay with it.
Do you want to add something there about creating a, in connection therewith, creating a public trust?
Yeah, something like that.
Because then we define the trust, so that would probably be where it should go.
I have to just reiterate that, again, this is Sarah Pilati for Mr. Cordero and Mr. Prestige. I think the title, again, is currently written, completely omits a very critical section of this initiative, which is those permits that we talked about, regardless of the date of any applicable local, state, or federal permit. I think to allow the title to go forward with no mention of a pretty critical section of the initiative is going to be extremely misleading to voters.
And for what it's worth, I'm inclined to agree with that. I do think we should have some reference to that.
Okay.
Can I quickly suggest, maybe before we get to that, a way to clean up part of the mess that I created? So saying creating a public trust in those resources, and then comma, which include or are defined to include, and then go over to clean air, et cetera. Okay. And then I don't know where you want to put the other part.
Yeah, wherever you want to.
Maybe after impairs them is part of the same clause, or yeah, on line 7 would be my first instinct.
So I wonder if it might work better after the impairment on line 6.
Okay.
And just, I mean, maybe it's something like...
regardless of whether the impairment occurred... I mean, really, it seems like it's, regardless of whether, the impairment was initially authorized or something like that, because, I mean, that's what it's really saying. I know, but that's not that, it's not entirely accurate, but, I mean, the only purpose of this, regardless of the date of permits thing seems to be, is if we find this, if a court finds this to be create a substantial impairment, they essentially don't care whether the person's been authorized to do it, if I read it right.
Right. That's... That's the way I think it reads, too.
I mean, I think I almost say regardless of whether any, you know, government or government entity or whatever, you know, previously authorized the activity that resulted in the impairment. I know that's way too long, but something like that seems...
Well, the other way to do it would be something like applying its provisions to any public action or commercial dealing that, regardless of any applicable local, the state or federal permits or something like that, the date of.
Well, let's... Yeah, thank you. I'd like my question for you is what are you trying to do with this subsection 5, and what's it do in your mind?
Well, I think that substantial impairment is a concept that exists regardless of whether an activity has been authorized or not. So it may cause certain activities to cease. So I would suggest that you say regardless. And then you, regardless of...
Okay. I think I would say something like, on line 6 after against, maybe, yeah. Any, and then put it like an including clause, including impairment that results from previously authorized or previously permitted actions.
Couldn't you just say regardless of, I mean, I like the basic structure, but why not just regardless of any applicable local, state, or federal permits, or regardless of the date of any?
Regardless of government permits?
Yeah.
Just something like that?
Yeah. I mean, that's the sense of it, I think.
Right. I mean, the basic point is, so I got my permit to drill this year, so I'm drilling. This would subject me to the provision, the substantive provisions, even if I couldn't walk in and say, well, I already have my permit, right. Leave me alone, right? Right.
Yeah, you might be able to dry up a river, but with this, you might not be able to dry up a river. So.
Okay.
I'm not sure that fully captures it, and in particular, I doubt that it fully captures the important aspect of retroactivity, and I think even the phrase that's been added would not be understood by the usual voter to be retroactive, which Section 5 clearly is. Maybe a way to begin to address that might be to say regardless of any previous federal, state, or local approval.
Works for me.
I would prefer existing.
Well.
Or pre-existing.
Yeah.
I was going to say prior.
Well, okay, it's the same. Yeah. Prior or pre-existing,
I'm okay with prior. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's better.
Okay. Can you accept them, Stephen, so I can look at it? Anything else?
Give me a second. You know, this goes back. I mean, I think it's a reflection of the single subject challenge here, but we have an and in our single subject. I mean, do we think, if we think natural and environmental resources are two different things, then maybe we keep it there. Otherwise, I would suggest that maybe we pick whichever one we may think is broader, or just say, well, I don't know if we'd want to just say resources. That's no. Even too much, but just a thought.
Yeah, I'm okay with it as is. I'd be okay picking one or the other, too.
I'm fine putting an and in the subject.
Okay.
I know you guys are.
I'm not going to push. I just thought.
I never really have understood that obsession either. But I know it exists. I'm inclined to leave it, I guess, for now.
Okay. Let me read it then. It's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning public ownership of natural and environmental resources and in connection therewith creating a public trust in those resources, which include clean air, clean water, and the preservation of the environment and natural resources, requiring the state as trustee to conserve and maintain public trust resources by using the best science available to protect them against any substantial impairment, regardless of any prior federal, state, or local approval, seeking natural resource damages from anyone who substantially impairs them, and using damages obtained to remediate the impairment, allowing Colorado citizens to file enforcement actions in court, requiring any person who is proposing an action or policy that might substantially impair public trust resources to prove that the action or policy is not harmful, and criminalizing the manipulation of data reports or scientific information in an attempt to use public trust resources for private property. So my only question was right before we talk about do we need a semicolon
yes.
in the middle of all those commas?
Line six. After approval. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'll move that we deny the motions for rehearing, except to the extent that we have modified the title as it now appears on the screen.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay. All right. So it passes 2-1, and that takes us to motion for rehearing. Are we doing 129 next? Is that what you said? Okay. 129. All right, counsel, you want to tell us about our potential jurisdictional problem, and then let's talk about single subject jurisdiction.
Okay. Jurisdictional problem other than single subject?
Sharon did this one.
Oh, okay. And just for the record, Mr. Gallander will be hearing this one. Ms. Eubanks heard it last time, but to accommodate.
Mr. Blake did too.
And Mr. Blake heard it last time, but to accommodate the. Proponent schedules, we're trying to get this out of here this morning.
Okay. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Chip Schoenberger, and I represent the objector. I'll try to keep this brief. It might have been the comment about the boiling frog, but I'm going to try to get to the point here. I have two arguments. One is a jurisdictional argument, single subject, and the other is the language of the measure itself. This relates to the definition of fee, and as that's presented in kind of that succinct manner, it seems fairly innocuous. But I think if you look into the actual language of the proposed initiative, it's far broader than that. First of all, it purports to amend Article 10, Section 20, which is Tabor. And the word fee only appears in that section one time in relation to attorney fees. But if you go down a little bit further, it also relates to not just to the Constitution, but also to every conceivable legal concept basically under the sun. It relates to all revised statutes, all codes, directives, and the catch-all phrase, all public Colorado legal documents. And although the collective wisdom of the board is certainly greater than mine, I cannot even conceive of the breadth of that statement. Who's to say really what falls under that broad umbrella? It's just simply off the charts in terms of broadness in my perspective. And as to the extent it also relates to superseding the Supreme Court's decision in Barber, well, that decision drew a distinction between fees, the meaning of fees at the point that they are imposed, and what happens and how those fees are characterized after the fact once they're in the hands of a government agency. So at a minimum, we have multiple subjects that fall under the broad umbrella of all legal Colorado public documents or something to that effect. And the distinction between the various temporal characterization of fees depending on whether it's at the point of intake or subsequently. If the board has any questions on that, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll move on to the language characterization, unless you'd like to take those separately.
Well, I think I do want to take it separately because we have a separate jurisdictional issue. But how do you reconcile that with, like, Fort Collins v. Bloom and other cases that have said what a fee is? I mean, aren't they essentially just saying what's already in Tabor?
Well, again, like I said, Tabor only mentions attorney's fees, which certainly doesn't fall under my reading of this description. I think the problem is really all Colorado legal documents. I really don't even know what that means. Are we talking about penalty fees? Are we talking about land transactions? In all honesty, it seems incredibly broad to me, to the point of being almost incomprehensible in terms of its scope.
But, I mean, doesn't the prior case law say that a fee has to be reasonably related to the, I mean, even before Tabor?
Certainly it does. But my issue is, what are we talking about in terms of fee? I mean, the word fee appears everywhere. This isn't even necessarily limited to certain types of fees. I mean, we're talking about the universe of fees. That is simply incredibly broad.
If I may, but I mean, broad doesn't mean that much. I mean, this is being put in the Colorado Constitution. Even without that language, doesn't this supersede any other, maybe not other constitutional provisions, but certainly anything statutory, the courts, and anything else that's in conflict just because it's in the Constitution?
Doesn't it supersede? Is that the question?
It does it not?
Well, certainly, and that's the way it's written. But I think we're talking about a definition. You know, you're also getting to the point of application. The definition of fee is going to attach to wherever that word appears, but the application of how we interpret that becomes confusing because of the way that the definition is written. If you're talking about some other kind of a fee, then it clearly doesn't apply, but that's an application and interpretation question. And I'd also point out that simply on Barber alone, the fact that this purports to supersede Barber does distinguish between the fee at the point of intake and what happens after it. The meaning of fee can change under Barber after it's been received, but under this language, it eliminates that distinction. So you're addressing an established meaning of fee at two different points, and you're merging them into one. And to me, that's a multiple subject issue.
Well, I mean, I don't see what it really does to. I don't see, I guess, rolling back Barber as a. I mean, the fee is still up front, must be collected for the. It's still going to be reasonably related to the payer's fair share of the costs, right? And this is basically saying, and once that's incurred, you're not going to be able to transfer it. You have to use it for that purpose for which you collected it.
Although under Barber, if the if the purpose of the fee is to fund the general expenses, what could be a fee at intake can become a tax after the fact. And this says that a fee is a fee is a fee is always a fee, and that's not necessarily the case under Barber.
That's not what Barber said. Barber said it didn't become a tax when you transferred it. It said it depends on why you collect it. I mean, when they moved all that money in Barber, the court said the court didn't convert it to a tax. The court just said you could make that move as long as you basically in good faith collected your fee for this purpose. I mean, I don't remember if Barber had to do with it was a bunch of funds that were overfunded in the state, right? And so then they decided they didn't need the money in the funds. Mm-hmm. As long as you don't fraudulently go out and collect money pretending you're going to use it for one purpose and then move it, that's what makes it a tax. I mean, Barber pretty much said, look at the purpose for which it was collected. If it was collected legitimately, you know, for that purpose, and then you find out later you don't need it, you can move it, and it doesn't lose its characterization as a fee. It doesn't convert it into a tax.
Well,
if you collected it illegally up front, mm-hmm. then it was a, I mean, if it really wasn't a fee up front, then it was a tax.
Well, and that was the outcome of Barber, but I guess the reverse scenario implies that if it is collected for a different purpose, even though it's a fee when it comes in, if it is dispersed in a different way after the fact, it could become a tax, or at least it could be viewed as a tax. And
but that's
by
true
attaching
anyway.
A definite, I'm sorry,
but isn't that true anyway? I mean, if I'm a government and I say I'm going to build a reservoir, knowing the whole time I'm not really going to build a reservoir, but mm-hmm. I go and I collect tap fees for this reservoir, and it comes out later that I never planned to build a reservoir, and then I move all the money into the general fund, then the court's going to tell me that that money is subject to Tabor, and it was a tax, and you're going to have to refund it subject to Tabor or ask the taxpayers to keep it or do something,
mm-hmm.
right? But if I really was going to build a reservoir, and then I find out later that I can't because the EPA won't approve it or whatever, I mean, to me, that's kind of where Barber was saying, you know, we can't just tell people if they over-collected on one end for a legit purpose that the money's just going to sit there forever.
Sure.
You have to be able to do something with it.
Sure. And as I read the language, this sets the definition of fee. It takes away the ability to interpret it in a different way. And the section right after that, beginning at line 21, I think maybe clears that up a little bit. And it says that the ancillary or extraneous benefits that may come are immaterial to the definition of fee. You don't have to take that into consideration, which is not what the language, albeit not the ultimate result of Barber, but the court's sentiment in Barber runs contrary to that.
All right. The secondary jurisdiction question, Stephen, can you just, for the record, regarding the timing of all of this, so in case the...
So yesterday evening, I received a forwarded email from Mark Gruskin with Chip's address, indicating that he had sent us the motion for rehearing Wednesday prior to close of business. And that email has yet to show up in my inbox. So I have requested help from our information technology department to find out where the email went. But we did receive a copy of the motion for rehearing, and we did receive an indication that it was timely filed.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Okay, and I'll add to the record if you'll indulge me for just a second on that, because I do have, I know Mr. Ward said he got a copy of the motion. I have an extra copy if you'd like me to submit it. But otherwise, I also have a copy, several copies actually, of the email itself, as well as I interpret this as a delivery confirmation. It's at least a confirmation that it was delivered to the server. There was no bounce back that it was actually accepted by the server, but it was certainly delivered. So I can put these in the record if I can approach or hand these to Mr. Ward.
Sure, we have. But yeah, why don't you put yours in the record?
So. Okay.
So I believe that our information security department could probably elaborate on that. But from a technical standpoint, in spam prevention, it's common practice not to have your server acknowledge if it bounces or fails to deliver an email, because you don't want the other side to know that the email address is an actual live email address. And what this notification says is, delivery to these recipients or groups is complete, but no delivery notification was sent by the destination server, indicating potentially, from my limited technical knowledge, that our server failed to acknowledge that the email was received. And if you're, what you told me earlier today was that you did request a red receipt on that email?
Correct.
So when I open those routinely, Outlook will ask me if I want to send the red receipt. I always click yes. There are other attorneys in this room that have probably received red receipts from me previously on their emails. So like I said, we appear to have had some technical issue. I have everything filed, and I have no reason to disbelieve that the email was actually sent. It's just not arrived.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to come up and...
Madam Chair, Board, Peter Coulter, along with Lisa Brumfield, proponents. A couple things. The definition that we put into this initiative was straight from the U.S. Supreme Court. Didn't change anything. It was in a decision and findings from the Supreme Court. Everything else after that was at the advice of the legislative council over the Capitol. And so we added those things about Barber, which I think the fee definition by itself takes care of Barber without having to mention it, but they asked us to. And it's the definition. We just have a definition for the entire state. And so Barber versus Ritter, they skewed, there was not a definition, and so they skewed the meaning of the word fee, where they said it doesn't make any difference what happens at the back end of it, where it goes. It makes it a fee how it comes in at the front end. And so with that, they were able to, I mean, the best example is raise car registration fees from $10 to $60 or $70 and include enterprises, bridge enterprises, as part of the registration fee. So this just puts everything back the way it should be, with no illusions as there are now.
I just have one brief question. With the language, it's a little interesting how you talked about it. Says it supersedes the findings of fact in Barber v. Ritter. If it does that, then presumably what it's saying is that Barber v. Ritter, that money really was a tax, not a fee. If it's a tax under Tabor, money illegally kept, it needs to be refunded with interest. Do you believe that this measure would require a refund of all the money that was kept and allowed to be kept under the Barber decision?
No, but as a point of the time, if it's enacted, okay, from that point forward, we're not going to be able to use that perverse language that they used in the Supreme Court in Barber versus Ritter. If it's anything other than a fee, it can't go into the general fund, and it has to be used exclusively for what the purpose was or is.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Now, I guess I don't know if this is really going to have a question mark or a period at the end, but the focus on Barber to me seems maybe to be a little bit leading us astray. The example of the car
registration
fees, the bridge enterprise, seems like a much better example. But that's a different scenario than, I think, quite different than Barber. The court's basic point in Barber was, hey, even applying a definition somewhat similar to what you have here, at the outset in Barber, this was kind of meant to reasonably approximate the costs. And then it turned out that there was extra money in there. Whereas I think what you're really trying to get at is the more common scenario, like the Bridge Enterprise funding, where there's sort of this generic benefit and the tying between the fee, what's now called a fee, and the benefit is really pretty loose, right? I mean, your car fee is connected to the weight of your car, et cetera, but I assume what you're saying is that would fail under this. But that, to me, is a different question than what happened in Barber. And I just want to make sure I'm understanding kind of what this really is after. I mean, is this after just the Barber scenario where a little extra money, it turns out the government says, well, we think it's going to cost about this much per applicant to run this program. Turns out it costs a little bit less than that. Or is this meant to be the other scenario where, you know, you call this new revenue source a fee, but it's only kind of not as directly tied to the benefit of an individual payer as this definition, I think, is meant to do?
Well, after Tabor, I mean, it's pretty well known that the government was looking for a way to fund things. And then they came up with, actually, in the two lower courts, it failed. And then in the Supreme Court, of course, there wasn't they didn't use to have a real definition of fee. They made their definition of fee as to intake and how it's, goes after that, and it can go into the general fund like a tax. So we're saying that it cannot go into a fee is like as it always has been before then, that it cannot go into the general fund, and it has to use specifically for the purpose that it was intended. The part about the reference to Ritter was at the suggestion of the Legislative Council.
Right, and I guess my point is, that to me is a different, or a related, but somewhat different question, where you have, I mean, the point in that case was, these were basically what I think at the outset, if you set them up right, would look like, would qualify under your definition as fees. The problem was they were too large. The fee was too high to pay for the benefit, the problem from your
Correct.
Perspective, right? And so there was leftover money that the government then took and put in the general fund, used for other purposes. That to me is a somewhat different question than what I think a lot of people think is the problem with the definition of fee versus tax, which is that really, you can call a tax a fee because as long as there's some kind of incidental benefit or you benefit from this program in some generic way, that qualifies. And I thought that this was intended to kind of tighten up that aspect, and which was not really the problem in Barber, I don't think. I think it was a different issue. In Barber. Now, you may be solving both of those issues here, but I don't know that kind of the focus on Barber is confusing me about what we're really after. Are we really after, okay, so we're really after kind of if the fee is too big, what you do with the excess, or are we really after kind of things that should be not fees at all being considered fees? And that, to me, is slightly different. And I thought that was kind of the bigger issue that this was trying to deal with.
Well, I would respond that it's probably both. I mean, this thing got obscured when the Supreme Court did Ritter versus Barber versus Ritter. Before, I mean, the definition by the Supreme Court is exactly what the fee is supposed to be. I mean, if it costs you $5 to provide a service to the public, and that's all you can charge voluntarily. Okay, voluntary. You can't go on and then add on ancillary things, okay, just so you can get bridges built or whatever you want. So you can raise income. Then it becomes a tax. Then it's that's when it becomes the tax. And so this, if you're going to call it a fee, if you want to call it a fee, this is going to define those actions of the government.
Okay. And let me just make sure I'm clear, because Mr. Schoenberger brought up a couple of other points about the not the definition itself of fee, but the what it applies to. And so what's on 11 through 13, I think it's pretty clear reading the measure as a whole. What you're talking about is the distinction between taxes and fees, a government charge. The problem that I think is would be solved by reasonable interpretation is that there are other kinds of fees that are discussed in the Constitution and statutes, codes, and other public legal documents. Attorney's fees, things like that, is just one example. It would be impossible, it seems to me, to apply this language to something like a requirement that someone pay attorney's fees in a losing lawsuit or that sort of thing.
Correct, but where do I start? I mean, I start accepting each item? I mean, I can't do that. I mean, I have to start somewhere.
Right, I just want to make sure your intent is on the record.
Oh, sure.
And that what you're talking about is the distinction between taxes and fees and trying to sort of recalibrate the balance between those two things.
No.
Not affect things that are sort of what other people might charge each other. You know, there's limits on what private people can charge.
Whatever private, if it's private, it's not affected by here. So it's public. It's in the definition.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Uh-huh. Thank you.
So, I assume, ready for just a motion on jurisdiction?
Sure.
All right. I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing to the extent we find that proposed initiative 2013-14, number 129, has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Do we need to say any? I mean, obviously we're going on the, we're acting as if we accept that the petition motion was filed
right
on time, which I think is correct, but I just know we haven't made an actual record on it other than the discussion.
Right.
Can I make a record on that real quick? I don't have any objection. I don't think anything happened, and I just assume that it not be a part of the issue because I don't want to have to go through Supreme Court and come back and go through these other things. So I believe everything was copacetic here with the record.
Okay. All right. That takes us to the question. Council, do you have any comments on the language?
I do. And I think basically the theme of my comment is error by omission. The submission clause in the actual title really it only mentions the Constitution. It doesn't mention any of the other aspects of Section 1, which includes its application to all other legal documents, all statutes, codes, charters, as well as the treatment of Barber. So I would propose that it's misleading in that respect. The voters wouldn't really understand what they're signing up for with regard to the scope of its application. And so I believe it's defective for failing to incorporate those concepts as well.
All right. Thank you. Do you have anything else you want to add?
Just real quickly, as far as Barber and those things, again, those were the suggestions of the Legislative Council, and we incorporated it in there.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Oh, I guess I'll comment on the objections. First, as I think I said before, I think the whole bit about what, you know, all the different kinds of laws and things that this applies to is just sort of the case with any constitutional amendment. I don't think it's particularly material or central feature for this initiative. I also feel that in light of the proponent's statement on the record, which, you know, becomes legislative history for this, I think it makes sense that there is no effort here to try to force a refund of the money, you know, actually overturn Barber-Rear to that extent, that this is only prospective. I think that that provision is essentially clarification more than anything else. I don't think we need to include that either.
Yeah, I would have been okay if the board wanted to discuss that it includes all these, that it applies kind of not just to the Constitution, but I also think I agree that that's generally a constitutional definition will control pretty broadly.
Any changes to the language, either of you?
No, I think as long as we're comfortable that not including that it applies to statutes, et cetera, as long as we're okay with that, I'm okay with the rest of the language, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. The only thing I might do is just whether we just want to say defining a fee as opposed to establishing a definition of a fee.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah. Want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we deny the motion. I'm sorry. That we deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that we've amended the title and set the title as it appears on the screen for proposed initiative 2013-14, number 129.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to number 122.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Martha Tierney. I'm here on behalf of objectors Caitlin Leahy and Gregory Diamond. Proposed initiative 2013-2014-122 impermissibly contains more than a single subject, and the board lacks jurisdiction, therefore, to set a title. I'll commence with the jurisdictional arguments, if that's what the board would like to start with.
Sure.
Okay. The initiative 122 contains at least two separate subjects. The initiative prohibits and constrains local governments from exercising their existing authority to regulate some aspects of oil and gas development. It does this in part by declaring for the first time that oil and gas development is a matter of statewide concern. Now there is dual jurisdiction on some matters for state and local jurisdictions, and this measure removes that dual jurisdiction. And secondly, it establishes a new floor for all development, and that floor is the state laws enacted by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission or the General Assembly. As a result, the measure contains two subjects and should not be titled. I'll let Chantel address the jurisdiction issues, unless you have questions on that.
No.
And then we'll go to the... Thank you. Sorry, Ms. Taylor. Far too informal here.
It's Friday.
We all are.
Good morning. Chantel Taylor, appearing on behalf of the proponents Randy Pye and Amy Williams, both of whom are here today. I want to thank the board for their indulgence with our travel conflicts yesterday and continuing until today so that they could be here, and they have affidavits on record as well. So the objector's motion is interesting because it's based on this premise that local authority to regulate oil and gas is pretty well established, and that 122 has this inherently misleading and problematic jurisdiction issues with single subject. When in fact, just bear in mind through all the arguments today that the objectors here are the same proponents for initiatives 90 and 93, and that will be really relevant as we go forward. This issue that comes up in the motion and the theme of their motion, that local authority is so well established, I think is contradicted by the fact that we've heard many initiatives about local control, and that the objectors slash proponents themselves have submitted several initiatives trying to clarify this issue of local control. So when we talk about single subject, they raise a couple issues. First, I would simply submit that the title could not be more clear. I mean, of all the ones that have been set in these in this election cycle, this one's pretty tight. The single subject is clearly stated as local governments may enact and enforce local laws. You have the language up. May enact and enforce local laws that are no more restrictive than and don't exceed or conflict with state law. When examining a single subject, courts will consider the initiative as a whole. They will not piecemeal out, as the objectors have suggested here. It has to be read in context and in its entirety. So we have our single subject, which then objectors take, and they're misconstruing this really succinct language by piecing it out and then embellishing a bit about what it actually does. So they say the initiative prohibits and constrains local governments from exercising their existing authority to regulate some aspects of oil and gas development. That's apparently one subject. And then secondarily, mandates that local law may not be more restrictive than or conflict with laws and regulations adopted at the state level. Well, the board should reject this approach, because clearly what they've done have taken two pieces of a whole. This must be read together. The types of laws that local governments may enact are those that are not more restrictive than and do not exceed or conflict with state law. There's nothing in the initiative or the language that suggests there's different aspects of oil and gas development that are prohibited or constrained, and there's certainly no mandate. This is clarifying the extent to which local governments may regulate oil and gas. The objectors suggest that, and we're stating for the first time in the initiative, that there's this matter of statewide concern, that oil and gas development is a matter of statewide concern. First of all, that wouldn't affect the single subject, because this is all relating to the extent to which local governments can enact laws regulating local or regulating oil and gas development. So that's interconnected and related. It doesn't stand alone. It's not a separate subject. But even in their own cases cited in their motion, you know, there is this recognition of state primacy. And there's, I lost the site. I think it's the Board of County Commissioners, La Plata County versus the COGCC, cited in their motion, 81P3rd, 1119, where they talk about local regulatory authority could be required to yield to the state's authority using preemption analysis. This is not the first time this concept has come up. In fact, there's been much tension, and it's no secret that there's much tension between the extent that local governments and state governments have the authority to regulate in this area. The objectors, as proponents, submitted over a dozen different initiatives related, my numbers may be off by one or two, submitted initiatives on this subject. This board has considered at least half a dozen, if not more. We also have lawsuits between state and local jurisdictions and threatened lawsuits that are attempting to ban activities like fracking, moratoriums. So I guess my point is that not only is this not creating some, you know, this isn't a new declaration or new topic that should stand alone, this preemption and state primacy issue. It's all connected to the issue that is the subject here. And just like the objectors initiative, 90-93, initiative 122 is trying to give voters a choice about where that authority starts and ends. And that's going to be an issue in this election year, because presumably some of these will go forward. Initiative 122 gives the voters a choice as to how that conflict should be reconciled. That's one subject. And we would submit that the board, therefore, has jurisdiction to set title, and we should proceed accordingly.
Thank you. Any questions of either?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Want to make a motion?
Sure. Well, I certainly have no, I'm unconvinced by the motion for rehearing that there's not a single subject here. So I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing to the extent that it, and find that we have that the measure has, I move that we deny the motion for rehearing to the extent that we find proposed initiative 2013-14 number 122 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Let's go to the language.
Thank you. Martha Tierney again on behalf of the objectors, Caitlin Leahy and Gregory Diamond. I think it's important in considering the language to point out some of the things that Ms. Taylor said in terms of what the standard for oil and gas development at the local level is now. She talked about the doctrine of preemption, which currently does exist, yet there is good Supreme Court case law about how where the local regulations can be harmonized with the state interests, that they must be given effect. This initiative would take that authority of local governments away. And the title is misleading because it does not allow the voter to understand that. In fact, I think we all know that what this is trying to do is get the voters to think it's a local control measure when it's really not. It's a state control measure. It's a measure that establishes a floor with the either state law or regulations coming out of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So in terms of the misleading nature of the title, it starts out saying that local governments may enact and enforce, but local governments already have that authority. And I think it's very misleading to the voters to suggest that this is giving them something that they don't already have. In fact, what it's doing is taking away something they have now. What it really should begin with is that state law is a floor and local governments must adhere to it, not local governments may enact, because it's misleading the voters into thinking that this is a grant of authority to local governments, and it's really a constraint on authority to local governments.
What if it was local governments may only enact?
That would help.
Okay.
Let me address another issue that I want to just make a record of, and that's this conflicting issue that we spoke about when the measure was titled. Here, the statute states that at 141.063b, Titles shall not conflict with those selected for any petition previously filed for the same election. And there's case law interpreting that. I'm specifically referring to the, I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, but Paredes v. Corey, In Re Title Bout, Title and Submission Clause 2007-2008-61 at 184 P3rd 747, Colorado Supreme Court 2008. In that case, the court said that the point there is that a conflict exists where the titles fail to accurately reflect the distinctions between the measures, and voters comparing the titles would not be able to distinguish between the two proposed measures. My concern is that this board has already titled a number of measures on local control. In this measure, the way it is framed is disguised to look at like another local control measure when it's really a state control measure. And I think that changing the language in the title to make sure that voters would understand that this is not a local control measure but a state control measure is paramount to ensure that we don't have a violation of 140-106-3B. In terms of the why it's misleading, and I think I've hit on this rather hard, but let me just state that it implies that it's creating for the first time this authority for local governments to regulate oil and gas. In fact, they already have that authority. They have a rather broad authority in terms of land use, surface estate use. And other environmental regulatory authority, and this is stripping them of that authority by ensuring or mandating that what they adopt is only as strict as regulation adopted at the state level. So rather than creating initial authority for local governments to regulate oil and gas, the true intent is to create new limits on current local government authority by substituting the Colorado Supreme Court's existing preemption standard for a new standard mandating that local government requirements can be no more restrictive than state requirements. So let me stop there, and then if the board has questions as we look at the language, I'd be happy to help.
Thanks. Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Chantel Taylor appearing on behalf of the proponents of 122. So I'll start with the conflicting issue and then I'll get to the misleading issue. So the objectors argue that title for 122 should be denied because it conflicts with their initiatives, in which their proponents, 90 to 93, and other local control. But in so arguing, the objectors really, I think, have misinterpreted the statute or misconstruing it here. And I'm not sure if they're making a jurisdictional argument or just that we should tweak the language. I think the latter. But 140-106-3B simply states that ballot titles, they shall be brief, which this is, shall not conflict with those selected for any petition previously filed. A conflict exists where the titles fail to accurately reflect the distinctions between the measures, and voters comparing them couldn't tell the difference, right? So that courts will construe this as language, an issue with language in setting the title, not so much first to file wins, right? So it's not as if these initiatives can't move forward. We just have to find a way to distinguish them, which I think when you compare the two next to each other for the initiatives for 90 to 93, for example, and the other local government ones, which are quite lengthy, but for the matter here, I'll give those as an example. There's just no way that a voter could be confused as to what their different choices are. I also think we're getting, Ms. Tierney's getting a bit into the merits and how this is to be interpreted. And, of course, we know that's not the board's job here, is to make sure that these titles are distinguishable. Although there may be some similarities in concept between the titles, especially if there are separate provisions that are going to separate these apart,
the board can adequately set title that will distinguish them. So let's just talk on its face. Local governments may enact laws and regulations concerning oil and gas development that are no more restrictive than and do not exceed state law. Let's take Initiative 90, for example, which they say is one that conflicts. The concept of enacting local governments being enabled to enact laws is actually in the middle of the paragraph. It's set in. So what it says is it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning local government's regulation of oil and gas development, and in connection therewith, increasing local government authority to prohibit or limit oil and gas development, authorizing local laws and regulations that are more restrictive and protective of community health, safety, welfare, and the environment than state law, a much more comprehensive list than we have here, declaring that if state laws and regulations conflict, the more restrictive law and regulations govern, and specifying that such laws and regulations are not a taking of private property requiring compensation under Colorado Constitution. So you compare that to what we have here, and I think voters have a pretty clear choice. Now, in the language, we certainly could have stopped with, in the initiative and in the title, local laws and regulations concerning oil and gas development or operations that are no more restrictive and no more restrictive than state law, for example. But we go on to say, so it's abundantly clear, no more restrictive than and do not exceed or conflict with state law. So I think the statement is abundantly clear as written. If you look at their version, which they cite in their motion, they say the initiatives in 91, 92, 90 to 93, all sponsored by the same proponents, authorize local governments to regulate oil and gas development in their communities in a manner that is more restrictive and more protective than laws set at the state level. I don't think it makes it inherently misleading or fatally flawed if you have the inverse statement, right? No more restrictive. So to the extent that the board found that this was not misleading and set title in 90 through 93, and to the extent that the objectors argued vigorously that that was a clear statement of their intent, I would think those same arguments would apply here. And I think that there's plenty of things that set it apart. So I think we've successfully distinguished between this one and the others that they point out, which are much more comprehensive, contain more provisions, and make it clear, even when you read the initiative itself, it includes things like fracking bans and prohibitions, which this doesn't include prohibitions. So I submit that the statutory the statutory requirement expressed in 140-106-3B has been met. Voters have a discernible choice between recognizing local government's authority to regulate oil and gas in a way that does not conflict with state law and allowing local governments, to ban fracking without just compensation. I mean, I think those are two very different concepts, and voters are at least sophisticated enough to figure that out. And then, of course, in the event that both initiatives are adopted by the voters, there's precedent for that, right? So the one with most yeses win. As stated in case law 873 P. 2nd 718, nothing prevents two conflicting amendments from being proposed or even adopted at the same election. What is prohibited is conflicting ballot titles, and that's what we're talking about in 140-106-3B. Again, in our view, there's a clear and discernible difference between the two. Where two constitutional amendments are adopted, which are in direct conflict with each other, the one receiving the greatest number of yeses prevails. So let me then just address, so on the issue of conflict, you know, I would submit that that part of the motion should be denied. Let me address the misleading argument. Objectors argue that the title is somehow surreptitious because it fails to inform voters that the rights of local governments are being taken away, not enhanced. First of all, again, I think this goes to the merits. You know, but the board is not required to interpret meaning of two conflicting provisions in initiatives or measures proposed, and really it's to make sure that we express clearly what's happening, what would happen if the initiative were to pass. So there is a whole universe of things that local governments may do with respect to local laws and regulations. There's nothing that is taking that right away in the initiative, and that's how it's explained here. Nothing that, you know, is to the extent that Ms. Tierney is arguing, nothing that is proactively picking out and taking away rights from local governments. It's saying where the boundaries lie, much like initiatives 90 to 93. They just have a different idea of what those boundaries should do. So take, for example, their language that says granting authority to local law, to local governments to pass local laws and regulations that are more restrictive and protective of community health, et cetera, than state law. So it's really just the inverse. So if her argument were to stand, then really we should be explaining in 90 to 93 that this isn't an initiative about increasing local governments' rights. This is actually an initiative about taking away states' rights. I mean, that's not what the board determined. The board determined that it clearly set those boundaries, and I would submit that the same argument applies here. They're really just the inverse of each other. I also think there's something sort of disingenuous about objectors' arguments when they have argued so vigorously on single subject, which was at least in one small part, there's a subject that overlaps, even though it's the inverse of each other and distinguishable. But I also think that, you know, that's just a blatantly inconsistent position to take. This issue about creating for the first time, I think there's something important in this. In their motion, they talk about how local authority is already well established, right? And there's a lot of emphasis on that in Ms. Tierney's comments. I guess, again, I would reiterate those arguments that if they were so long-standing and so well-established, I just don't think any of us would be here debating for days several initiatives that are attempting to clarify this issue. But the language in 122 says may enact and enforce local laws. There's no creation. There's nothing new. This is setting limits, right, and boundaries and clarifying what those limits are. In contrast, the language, if anybody's creating this new right or giving the misleading appearance that an initiative is creating rights where they didn't once exist, I'd submit that you look at 90, which says the people of Colorado hereby vest the right, power, and authority in local governments to regulate oil and gas development. I would submit that that language is much more misleading to the extent it's suggesting now by act of Initiative 90, the people of Colorado have now vested rights to local governments. If that's not misleading, surely a statement, which is much more benign, just may enact and enforce local laws, I think should not be deemed misleading. The board's job is really just to make sure that these initiatives don't conflict. I don't think it could be any more clear, and so I would submit that the motion should be denied on those accounts.
thank you. You don't have any questions?
Can I have one follow-up
point?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Martha Tierney again. I think one point I just want to make is that if it is the inverse of the other measures, the way the title should read would be stating that local governments are prohibited from enacting local laws and regulations that are more restrictive. Because the way it is written now, I don't think it's clear what a yes or a no means. It's not the inverse. So it should start with local governments are prohibited from enacting local laws and regulations concerning oil and gas development or operations that are more restrictive than and do not exceed. Thank you.
Chantel Taylor, there are two points I would submit on that. First of all, initiatives 90 to 93 chose to put those words, those are the words of their initiative, prohibition. If you were to put a prohibition in here, which are not words used in the initiative, that would be interpretive. You would be interpreting what the initiative does. And so I would submit that that's not the board's role, and so we would oppose that. I think the same argument applies with the word only, and I also think there's two problems with doing that. Oftentimes, local governments and private operators will contract for different standards, or there will be intergovernmental agreements, exceptions. I would be concerned about embedding, and I would think that the objectors would be concerned about embedding in the Constitution a prohibition or only, because then that actually narrows it far more and takes away that flexibility for governments, private operators, intergovernmental agreements, that there may be some flexibility, which this language was enacted, drafted in that way.
All right. I don't have a problem with the word only. I mean, it's not going to be embedded in the Constitution. It's in the question. So, if that's really what it's getting at and it's confusing the way it's written, I'm fine with that. I don't know if people have other changes.
Okay. First, I think it matters maybe where we put the only. I don't think I'd put it before an act on line one, because then it implies that maybe you are excluding other options they have. I think we should put it, however, on the second line to say something like, I'd also consider making it singular, but that's neither here nor there. Enforce local laws and regulations concerning oil and gas development or operations. And even though it's repetitive, to be really clear, I think I'd say only if the laws or regulations are no more restrictive than, and go on from there. Because then we're clear that we're limiting it to just laws and regulations. And we are, I mean, I agree with Ms. Taylor, that we do get into too much interpretation if we start talking about prohibitions or stuff, but I think the only does matter, because they may, I don't think that requires us to make a decision as to whether they are able to do more now or not. I think it just tracks the measure.
Your thoughts?
No, I'm fine with that. I think it probably helps clarify it. I thought we should probably get on the record about the conflict issue as well.
Okay.
Obviously, I don't think that provision has been interpreted to say that you can't write titles if there's measures that conflict, that try to do conflicting things. You just have to make it clear that that's what's going on. I think this accomplishes that. I don't think this is intended to be sort of misleading or to create confusion. It seems to me to be created to put the kind of two options on there and let people have at it. Even if it were meant to sort of be confusing. I once fell for that argument and voted against a measure, I think it was dueling affirmative action measures back in the day and was voted against a second one that used it basically everything but a not from another measure and was resoundingly reversed by the Supreme Court. So I think we're okay. This does try to do, I think, basically the opposite of what the others do. It does it slightly differently. I think the title doesn't conflict in the sense of someone who actually reads the titles should be able to understand that this does something very different than 90 to 93. So I'm okay with it on that grounds.
Madam Chair, may I have one more comment?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm Martha Tierney. I want to reiterate my point that I think it is hard to understand what a yes or no means when you read this, and that it would, rather than saying no more restrictive than, it should say make it clear that they have to be as strict or stricter, or because I think the no more makes it confusing as to whether it's yes or no, the answer. It's like a double negative.
Chantel Taylor, on that point and the only if, that's why the additional language is added in there to clarify in the initiative and in the measure itself. No more restrictive than, do not exceed or conflict with. I mean, I think that expounds upon the idea that it can't be more restrictive, they can't exceed or conflict. I think it's very clear when you look at the question below, you know, shall there be an amendment stating that local governments may enforce local laws and regulations, et cetera, that are no more restrictive than and don't exceed or conflict with state law. I just think it's very clearly stated. It does not constitute a double negative any more, you know, than creating this. Well, so I don't see any way that that could be treated as a double negative as I read it. Then when you're looking at the only if language, only if the laws or regulations, I mean, I would just preserve objection to that. I think it was perfectly clear the way it was before. That language is not in the initiative. And again, I feel like only if we deliberately avoided narrowing language because this is going in the Constitution. We take that very seriously. I feel like that could be interpreted to even the objectors, you know, disadvantage. It could be interpreted to anybody's disadvantage because it's more limiting and it's not the language of the initiative. And again, I think that that's interpretive. So I just want to preserve my objection. I think this title should stand as written.
Okay. All right. Well.
All right. Ready for a motion?
Sure.
All right. I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing except to the extent that we have amended the title as set last time for proposed initiative 2013-14 number 122. Was that coherent?
Yeah.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2013-2014 number 123. I just need to use the restroom.
Okay. I thought you might be getting up to do some sort of a happy.
Yes. Okay, we are back on the record on proposed initiative 2013-2014, number 123, for rehearing. Ms. Tierney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Martha Tierney on behalf of the objectors, Caitlin Leahy and Gregory Diamond. I would like to incorporate all of my prior comments for Initiative 122 into Initiative 123. I do have one additional issue I'd like to address on the jurisdiction, and that involves the issue of the impact fee that is created by Initiative number 123. So the initiative impermissibly contains several separate and distinct subjects. I want to focus on the fact that in addition to the two subjects I described in my remarks in relation to Initiative 122, Initiative 123 also creates a local government oil and gas impact fee. This initiative, therefore, sets up the kind of log rolling that the voters intended to prevent when adopting the single subject requirement. An elector going to the polls in the upcoming election might favor a local government impact fee while being opposed to depriving local governments of their historical authority to regulate land use, surface impacts, and health, safety, and welfare impacts of oil and gas development. Here, the fee, as contained in the language, it states that except that local governments may assess an oil and gas impact fee to mitigate the direct costs associated with oil and gas development and operations. This fee is separate and apart from the authority that is being taken away from local governments in Initiative 123, and is clearly a separate subject that creates a jurisdiction problem on Initiative 123. Similar to the issue described in the Howe versus Brown case, which was 2009-2010, number 91, and in that case, if I'm recalling correctly, there was a fee for a bottle cap fee. And that was found to be separate and distinct from the subject of the subject of the measure, and was considered to be exactly the kind of log rolling that the voters intended to prevent, where some voters might favor the fee, but they wouldn't favor the regulation that the measure, the initiative, was intending to put into the Constitution. So here we think that by creating a local government oil and gas impact fee, which does not presently exist, that the measure impermissibly contains more than one subject.
May I ask one quick question before we go? Can local governments impose an impact fee now?
So not to my knowledge on local governments right now have authority to regulate land use and surface stuff and environmental impacts, but they don't have the authority to regulate, for example, hydraulic fracturing or what goes in the ground or anything like that. And so currently, in terms of oil and gas development, I don't believe they have the right to impose a fee.
Thanks.
They might have the right to impose a fee on a zoning issue, maybe, or something like that, but not on specifically on oil and gas impact.
Thank you.
Chantel Taylor, appearing on behalf of the proponents. And just for the record, they are here today, the proponents for Initiative 123, Amy Williams and Randy Pye, and they have signed the affidavit, and that's on record. So I would also like to incorporate my comments from 122. And we'll focus just on the additional issue that's been raised here regarding the impact fee. At the outset, I want to make it clear that Ms. Tierney's argument is really based on a misreading or a misconstruction of what the initiative actually does. There is nothing in the initiative that creates an impact fee. This allows local governments to assess impact fees if they so choose, notwithstanding the conflict with state law. So this is exactly why initiatives and courts are very clear. You have to read initiatives together. You can't read them piecemeal. These are all related concepts. So the point of this initiative, and that's clearly expressed in the language and in the title, is to allow local governments to enact laws that are no more restrictive than state law, except local governments can enact assessment fees, impact fees, without concern about the restriction or conflicting with state law. So the impact fees are just one type of laws and regulations that local governments can enact to regulate oil and gas and to mitigate the direct costs associated with oil and gas. They may do that. That particular law, impact fee, could be more restrictive than and conflict with state law. So it has to be read together. Courts are clear about that, and I think that's why when you start pulling them apart, it's easy to say they don't make any sense. I think that to your question about whether impact fees are permissible now, it's my understanding that as it is now, environmental impact fees, there are some range of impact fees that, and I don't want to misspeak or misquote, but I do think that there are some environmental impact fees, and I think you recognize that in your comments. This clarifies that those costs associated with mitigation directly related, direct costs to mitigate oil and gas development, it just makes that clear. Local governments have that right, and it can be more restrictive than state. If we had put this in, and actually the way it was worded before, before review and comment at Ledge Council, it was embedded in the language, and we tried to make it clear. But the local government was saying, well, wait a second, the state doesn't allow impact fees. So you've basically put something in here that's an impossibility, right? So you've put in here that local governments can enact laws regulating oil and gas, including impact fees, that are no more restrictive, well, et cetera. That would be an impossibility because states don't have impact fees, and so it would conflict. So this was an attempt to address that from the review and comment, and I think it sufficiently does that. To the extent, you know, this is argued to be a separate subject, I think it's hard to see how it's not connected to those kinds of laws and regulations that local governments may enact. Therefore, I don't think it's a standalone. In that case that Ms. Tierney cited, you know, they really emphasized that issue about the piecemeal. And in that case, the fee, you know, the issue there was hit. It was hidden. Here, it's right on its face. So I don't think we have an issue. And I would submit that the motion should be denied because it looks like you're hungry.
Well, so I'll start with this kind of additional subject. This strikes me as not the sort of log rolling problem that the single subject is meant to deal with. If this were that they could impose some sort of additional fee for completely unrelated endeavors, then it might raise that problem. But this basically strikes me as kind of an exception or an effort to mitigate the reach of the measure that seems connected to it, not a separate subject.
I agree.
As do I.
Okay, well then I'll incorporate everybody's comments on the single subject topic from number 122 as well, and move that we deny the motion for rehearing on 2013-2014 number 123 on the single subject issue and move on to the title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Anything new on the title, or do you want to at least incorporate your prior comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Martha Tierney on behalf of the objectors, Caitlin Leahy and Gregory Diamond. I would like to incorporate all of my comments made earlier in response to our proposed initiative 122, and just reiterate that the language of the title is misleading, and the voters will have a difficult time discerning whether this is a grant of authority to local governments or a taking away of authority from local governments, which is what it is. And I think it could be better worded in a way that would make that clearer.
Thank you.
Chantel Taylor on behalf of the proponents for 123. I would just preserve my objection on the only if, but otherwise I think the title should stand.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have anything?
All right. Then I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2013-14 number 123, except to the extent that we've amended the title as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. And that concludes the rehearings. And it is now 12:20, and the meeting is adjourned.
Where's your dance?